If there's one thing that my family and friends know me for, it's being an amazing gift giver. I owe it all to Celebrations Passport from 1-800-Flowers.com, my one-stop shopping site that has amazing gifts for every occasion. With Celebrations Passport, I get free shipping on thousands of amazing gifts. And the more gifts I give, the more perks and rewards I earn. To learn more and take your gift giving to the next level, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Hi everyone, Sarah here, one of the co-hosts of the Squiggly Careers podcast. We have a special episode for you this week, which is a Squiggly Career story that I recorded with David Pearl back in January. David is the founder of Street Wisdom and the author of a book called Wonderful. And it was a brilliant conversation and something a bit different. So David talks about getting inspiration from the streets and the world around us. So we went for a walk and you will hear the kind of sights and sounds of London in the background as I talk to David. And it was such a brilliant conversation with so many nuggets of inspiration and wisdom, both from listening to David telling his own personal story of his career so far, but also advice and kind of actions that we can all take for our kind of day-to-day work, that we just wanted to have it as a kind of standalone extra episode. So I hope you really enjoy it. And I kick off with asking David three questions about his career so far. So here you go. When you were a kid, what did you want to be when you grew up?
A conductor.
Okay. One word to describe your career so far.
unfolding.
Ooh, I love that. Out of 10, how squiggly do you think your career has been?
Pretty squiggly. I'm coming in with a 7, I think.
Ooh.
Pretty
seven. I actually
seven
thought you might get higher after
yeah,
my research.
Pretty but, yeah. squiggly, yeah.
One person who's really inspired you in your career?
Charles Handy.
Oh, good. That's really good. Let's talk more about Charles. I thought you might go for Madeleine Albright.
I've just written this book, and in it, she describes herself as an optimist who worries a lot.
I know, I wrote that quote down. I loved that.
That's how I feel a little bit. I love life. It's great. And it's also scary.
Yeah. Final one. Dream job. So you've got to work, so you can't just be lying on a beach all day, but you could spend your time doing any kind of work. What do you think you'd do?
Well, as a kid, I wanted to be in Thunderbirds, which
Thunderbirds,
this idea that
go.
you were part of a kind of this elite team of people in your different places around the world, and the phone would go and you'd be called into action to do stuff. That's sort of the job I've got, I think. I've got these...
Do you feel like you're a Thunderbird?
I think I am a creative Thunderbird. I'd like to think so.
You've not got the outfit on, though, today.
You're not wearing today.
You're wearing orange, not the grey kind of jumpsuit.
The grey jumpsuit and the peak cap, the little capo thing.
So you said you wanted to start, when you were a kid, you were like, I want to be a conductor.
Yeah.
And when I was looking into all the different things you've done, of which there are lots to talk about, it sounds like you've had a very creative life. Describe to me, when you first started out working, what were you spending your time doing then?
Without sounding like a kind of lovey too much, I started work when I was 8 because I was basically plucked out of school and stuck on the stage at Covent Garden to sing.
Ah.
And that really does feel like when it began. It's when my kind of, I was a paid singer. And also, you know how kids are. They feel grown up.
What do you do with your money when you're 8? Buy loads of sweets.
Well, there was that. I actually bought, because I was a little nerd, I bought port. I remember my dad encouraged me, buy port, put it down. And we're still actually drinking
port.
The port that I couldn't drink it as an 8-year-old, but I am enjoying it in later life. So
that
I did
is the most
that.
Grown-up thing I think
I've
ever heard.
I know. Well, like kids think, I think you look at kids, you've got kids, right?
And yeah.
Kids are pretty serious and pretty grown up, I think. They think they are the right age. Other people are, they know there are people older than them, but this is the right age, right? And I remember being 8 thinking, this is, I was working with famous opera stars and I felt like, no, I mean, obviously I knew they were older than me, but I was one of them, so like a peer. And so I think it sort of slightly warped my expectations of life because it was a little bit Cinderella-like. I would, this lasted for about 5 years. I'd be at school during the day, at night I'd sing at the opera. Not every night, but lots of the nights. And I think it gave me an appetite for doing more than one thing, you know, and that's been a hallmark of my so-called career. And I think it was also, it woke up the performer in me. It also woke up, I loved rehearsal.
So you like the process as well as the kind of outcome?
Almost more, if I'm honest. There's something still to this day really exciting to me about what goes on behind the scenes. When I'm working with businesses, I'm often talking to them about backstage. Where's the backstage of life in professional life? A lot of people don't have one. They're like on stage, under the spotlight all the time, and they don't realise that actually performance, you need to go backstage. Anyway, that's one of the things I learned there. And from then on, the zigging and the zagging continued. So I was a kid, I was born into a Jewish family, and they have a thing about, you know, having a solid career and making a bit of money. So I had that imprinted on me.
Having a profession, maybe.
Exactly. What is your job? My mum still doesn't know what my job is. But so I sort of did a twin track thing. I was very arty, the arty boy, and I was in orchestras and singing and so on. But also I went to music college, but then I also went to Cambridge and did work. I did English and stuff like that.
Oh, wow.
So in my 20s, I was sort of copywriter by day and singer by night. So it was kind of...
still moonlighting.
Yeah.
Still keeping that going.
Yeah, and some people would say, well, which bit is the moonlighting bit?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Because they're both quite hard things to do. So I also had the great good fortune to write for Kubrick for a bit while I was at university as a writer.
What a claim to fame.
I know. Well, it was good luck and kindness on his part and Anya, his daughter's part. I was very interested in film, so I did some writing for him. And I had this kind of sort of broad set of what felt like disconnected skills. And
did that ever worry you?
Yes. It really did worry me. I spent a lot of my life, and it's only recently that it started to calm down and I've begun to see the red thread that holds it all together. But yeah, at times it really did. I'd often feel, this isn't me, or I should be doing something else. Like, I'm doing this, but over there is where I should be. So a constant sense of, I'm sort of in the wrong place.
Yeah, and I think sometimes, even when we say the word squiggly career to people, you can see a sense of relief.
Yeah.
That it's okay that maybe somebody's not had a traditional career path,
yeah,
or maybe not done what they expected they might do or what other people expected they might do.
Yeah.
And often when people kind of talk to us about it, I can see that actually sometimes people just need to feel comfortable with things being more unplanned, being more opportunistic perhaps, and that being okay and not being like the wrong thing
Absolutely.
To do.
Absolutely. God, it's like you're speaking what my brain is saying. I mean, I often, when I'm talking to business people, this word career is a funny one, right? Because when you were a kid, career officer, Mr. Peyton was on my
career. Told you were going to be what, a teacher,
well,
solicitor?
Well, that's right, exactly. But there was this idea.
It wasn't a long list, was it?
Not really. But the idea was that a career was sort of like a straight line thing.
Yes.
But actually, if you look it up in the dictionary, career means to, you know, to cascade down the side of a mountain in an uncontrolled manner. You know, to career is to, is to sort of tumble in an uncontrolled
like
way. And I think that you're right.
Oh, I
that
love
people's,
that.
People's shoulders drop when you say, you know, it's a verb, not a noun, right? And this leads us to probably why we're walking the street, because more recently I've been exploring, you know, wandering.
Yeah.
This notion of, you know, we're out here wandering. We're not going in a prescribed path from A to B. We're having a bit of a wander. And that, I think, looking back, has been a characteristic of my working life. I've been kind of off course a lot of time, but sort of feeling my way. The Chinese have that wonderful phrase, you know, you cross a river by feeling your way across the stones with bare feet.
Okay.
So you're not like plotting, of course. You go, I've basically got an intention, I want to go over there, but I'm going to feel my way by experimentation and literally feel, use my senses in my body. So the book I've just written, it's got a lot about embodied intelligence. You know, not just listen to what your head says, but listen to what your body says. Let, you know, be three-dimensional, find your way through life. Anyway, I'm rabbiting on, but it's exciting to me. I love that.
Yeah, and do you think, I think one of the challenges is that lots of us, and me included, love to plan, love to make a plan, love to have a plan, and it can feel quite overwhelming, quite daunting to think, okay, I can listen to what Sarah and David are saying, I buy into this idea of we're going to have multiple careers, on average now, I think people starting work apparently are going to have like four different types of career.
Really, really.
Which like now I think, well, I'm probably in my second, maybe even third type of career already.
Yeah.
And I always joke I've had more jobs and worked in more companies than my dad.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's that, it's not that unusual.
Yeah.
But equally, I don't think we're suggesting to people that you become completely hedonistic and just leave everything to kind of chance as well. And so you talked about that analogy of feeling the stones to find your way. As you've become more comfortable with your career and kind of having all these multiple different kind of threads and strands, what are the kind of ways that you've started to think about your own working life and how you spend your life? Is it much more about just worry about the next stone in front of you? Is it trying to figure out those consistent threads? What's kind of helped you get that comfortable? Or actually, do you love being spontaneous, so it's no big deal for you?
God, that's such a great question. I think it's both. I think you need a plan and you need to be free. I think just crashing about isn't super helpful. So, you know, when I'm again talking to businesses, you can see the planners going, oh, don't take my plan away. But I think you need a plan, but it's not sufficient, right? So it's important to have a plan and then to replan and replan. I do a lot of improv on stage, and it's a bit like that, which is you have to have a general direction, but then you have to adjust in the second. So I think
it's
that's
a bit
what
like we've just done. So we just got to a very busy road
and
just stopped because we thought, do you know what, that's going to be really busy.
Yeah.
We've just been walking along some lovely gardens.
Yeah.
It's all right to turn around and come back the way we've come from.
Yeah.
And kind of taking that moment and going, that's okay.
Yeah, and now what a lot of business would do is they would have sent out a squad of people and they would have drawn up PowerPoints and timed everything. And it's like there's this great sense of trying to control the future. Going to control what's happening, and that happens in organisations a lot. I mean, organisations like to be organised, but I think what's happening in the world, a friend of mine, Jim Garrison, puts it beautifully. He runs the Wisdom University, and he runs Ubiquity. He's a wonderful guy, and he says things are getting better and better and worse, faster and faster.
Yes, yeah.
And
kind of that better times, worse times.
Yeah,
I'm noticing
it. No, exactly. That's right. The sense that it's not better or worse; it's both, and the velocity of the oscillation between good and bad. It's not even daily, it's hourly. Now, in that world, you do need a plan and you need to be very responsive to what's going on. So
yes.
I think it's both.
Yeah, and I think this idea of and versus or,
yes,
from a language perspective, is really interesting. I do think now the idea of people going, actually, we talk to people about creating career possibilities rather than plans. We kind of prefer that language.
Nice.
But kind of going, and be adaptable.
Nice.
And be open to different opportunities.
Yes.
You know, some of the best career moves that I've made have been where I have moved out of maybe my area of expertise.
Yes.
Maybe where I've gone sideways rather than upwards.
Yes.
And they feel so brave at the time. And yet when you look back at them now, you think, oh, they're the things where I learnt the most.
Yes.
Because I was taking what I'd got with me and learning something new. And actually one of the pieces of career advice in the back of our book that someone shared with us was this whole idea of like, embrace the and, which it's really stuck with me, is going, you don't have to constantly be trading things off. You know, this whole like work-life balance thing and the idea of like work on one side and then all the other good stuff on the other. It's like, it's okay to want a great kind of career and to want to spend some time with your family. That's okay. This idea of and is okay.
It's not okay. It's essential.
Yeah.
It's saying, because you and I both know people who have sacrificed their life really for their work. And I often think of a lady that who's a friend of a friend of mine. She's a very, very successful career woman, but she's escaped a near miss in a car crash, and it was nearly perished. She got out of the car, got out her phone to call somebody to tell them that she was okay, and realised there was no one to call.
There's
no one that, you know, says, so there's that. And I think what you say, you know, this question of what have I learned as I've gone on about my sort of navigation system, I think what I'm learning is to look back as well, because you often learn about yourself about the choices that you made. You go, hang on. So, and I think what's happening, I mean, certainly if you look at the arts, the whole idea of stories, which I work a lot with stories and so on, is that the protagonist, the you in this, has all sorts of plans at the beginning of the story, but the purpose of the story is for the protagonist to learn about themselves, learn what they don't know. You know, we all have our blind spots, and the decision that you made when you were, you know, when you were 25 and a career opportunity came to you, there's something instinctive for you, went, this is nuts, but I'm going for that. Afterwards, you look back and go, oh, that taught me about myself, about who I am.
Yeah.
So at the age that I'm now, you know, we talked about the different things I've done, a red thread has emerged, has begun to emerge. And if you go back to that initial idea of me being a conductor, let me take you back to when I was a kid. My image when I was about six of the thing I wanted to be was a conductor. And the reason I think was because the conductor had a magic wand, had this white stick, and that appealed to me. And also I thought I'd get a cape. I thought I'd get a cape. And I had this.
So really, it's all about the props. You wanted the wand,
totally,
you wanted
the cozy. It's the cozy, right? And then I had this other idea, that I would fly around the world and I'd walk down this corridor and I'd come out into the light and there would be an orchestra there and I would wave my stick and I would conjure music out of them in a kind of semi-magical and semi-musical way. Other kids are dreaming of being a Maradona or a jet fighter pilot. That's what I was doing. Interestingly, many decades on, and I look back, that's kind of what I do. I only realize it's kind of what I do, which is I go around the world and I don't use a stick and I don't use music, but I work with groups of people all over the world and I sort of conjure conversations out of them, I conjure creativity out of them, and then I get back on a plane and go somewhere else. And so it's as though there's a sort of, I had to learn that by doing it.
Yeah.
All sorts of so-called wrong turnings. But there's this, I like this idea that the word opportunity, I recently found it means, if you look at it, it means the way to port. Port in the opportunity means a harbour. Opportunity, the way to get to the harbour. And I think a nice way of thinking about it is we're all bobbing along. We've got a sense of our, what I like to think of our essence, our element. You know, you feel great at work when you're in your element, right? Mm-hmm. But no careers officer is going to tell you what your element is. You're going to have to go and experience.
Yeah.
And then you find out retrospectively.
That point of learning by doing is really underestimated. Yeah. I still think too often learning or development is associated with sitting in a room in a workshop.
Yeah.
You know, don't get me wrong, we do those things. So those things are important. But I am actually a big fan of those things are only important if they then impact what you then do the next day at work, the next week at work. Yeah. And actually the majority, I think, of how we learn and where we learn the most is if you can learn, like almost and going back to that point about and, like learn and do things at the same time. So it doesn't mean you just turn up to work every day and just hope you're going to learn loads of stuff.
Yeah.
It actually means kind of active reflection, active learning whilst doing things and combining those two things together. And I think that's one of the things that I'm really interested in, like how do we create cultures and environments at work where people have the time and space to do that and it not feel like a luxury to stop and pause for a moment and reflect a little bit. So tell us a bit about Street Wisdom, about why we are walking the streets and what Street Wisdom means and why you started it.
Yeah, so Street Wisdom, it's a charity. It's actually what they call a community interest company.
Yeah.
But it's basically, it's a non-profit. It's now about 5-6 years old. And it came, like most things, in an unplanned way, like most good things. I'd been working, a bit like you, I think, in business. Bit surprised to be doing that, but you know, I found that my arts background turned out to be quite relevant to businesses that wanted to be doing things more creatively.
Yeah.
They wanted to, individuals wanted to present themselves more powerfully and generally make working life more sort of more interesting. And I've been sort of doing that on and off for the last 20 years or so. And part of that, I would often take people out of their offices and just walk around the streets. I say just walk around the streets.
Yeah, but getting out of an office is actually a really hard thing to persuade people to do.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's partly because, I've got to be at the office because that's where the work is. Is it?
Yeah.
That's where the phone is.
Yeah,
not sure.
Not anymore.
Not sure, exactly. But the other thing I think is it's where your identity is. And what's interesting to me about the streets is it's the space between our identities, you know, at home, dad, mum, lover, friend, DIY person, whatever. Work is whatever identity you've got, but you're walking through this neutral area, relatively neutral area. And it struck me as interesting because you can then play with different yous. So for example, I remember one time I was working with a COO that the business wanted to become a CEO. But the problem with it was that whilst he was very good at operations, he wasn't very interested in people. And therefore that's tricky for a CEO, right? So they said, can you work with him? And one of the things I remember doing with him was we sat in a cafe and I said to this guy, who's a real belt and braces engineer, see that guy over there, draw him. And he looked at me like I was completely mad. He said, I can't draw. I said, I don't care if you can't draw. Draw as well as you can. Yeah, but I'm no good at this. I said, well, I really don't care. Just draw the guy. Because it was about looking at somebody else and drawing. So he did it very reluctantly. I said, great. That's stage one. Now, go across the cafe and go give it to him. And he looked as a gift.
I would be really nervous about doing that.
It made me think, you know, maybe out here in so-called ordinary life, out here where customers live, where we really live, might be a good place to, you know, explore new types of behaviour, explore how you connect with other people, explore new ways of thinking. So I, like most things, you sort of fiddle about, right?
Yeah,
so I tried a bit of this, I had a bit of a play. And over the years, and it took many years, a structure which I call a walkshop emerged, which was a simple way of using the streets to be, get inspiration and learn. And it's got three stages. The first stage, you tune up your senses. The second stage, you go and ask a question and you see what inspiration you get. And the third stage, you share what happened with the other people who were doing it with you. Now, it sounds simple, and you know what it's like. It's much
simple's
easier to
hard.
Be complicated, right? Just taking years. And once having got it really simple, we gave it away. We put it online, gave it away. And it went berserk, really. It's in 41 countries,
wow.
I think.
We've I know had, so many people who've done it and who absolutely rave about it.
Oh, I'm so glad.
And the breakthroughs that they've had, with the thinking that they've had from doing it. So, yeah, that's actually how I kind of discovered Street Wisdom, was because lots of those advocates that you now have were telling me how brilliant it was and how much they enjoyed it, but also just how much it had helped their thinking, it often in quite unexpected ways. So is that kind of what's most rewarding, I guess, seeing the kind of journey that people go on?
It is really rewarding, particularly when it's 2 or 3 degrees of separation away from you. You know, if you look on Twitter and you discover in Buenos Aires they've done one,
yeah,
and people are getting a kick and learning stuff. Because I think when you've been doing what we do with businesses or with other people, you know, sort of effectively training, teaching, developing, you get quite good at twisting people's arms to make sure that they have a breakthrough. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But when you're not there,
when you're not there,
and
yeah,
you're nowhere near there, it's very gratifying to see that this approach really does work, and people get a lot from it. They get a huge range of things. You get people who have, you know, life-changing experiences. But at the other end of the scale, it's not a small thing that people have permission to wander, and they just reconnect with real life. And it sounds a bit pompous, but I remember doing a series of Street Wisdoms with Samsung, with younger people, and they're... They were store
Talking
managers.
About younger people, we're about to be approached by a school of kids, obviously out on a school trip, all with very good red hats on, which I'm very much liking.
But it's interesting, look at that. They are in a queue, right? They're being taught that the way to get on the street,
like
you
a
have
crocodile.
To go in a single file. Right? And actually, probably the person who's going to do the interesting stuff in their life is the one that's not obeying. There's one kid off.
There's one
on
kid
the right.
on the left.
Look, he's just doing his own thing.
You know, rogue, so, he's being a rebel.
Exactly. And I think that's it. I think when the world squiggles, squiggle. I don't know who said that, but someone should have said that.
And so if people listening are thinking, are intrigued by Street Wisdom, can anyone go and do it?
Yep.
How does it work?
Well, the way it works is people get intrigued and they look at the website and they discover that either there's an event going on near them, which they can go to, and the events are all free. We say you don't pay fees, you pay attention.
Nice.
And they're run by volunteers around the world, people that fancy doing it. Often these people they're people who are interested often in coaching or teaching, but not necessarily. They can just be people that want to do something different with their friends or with their family or with their colleagues. And you download the instructions, you say where you're going to do your Street Wisdom, it goes up on the site so that other people nearby, whether you're in Bogota or Birmingham, know that it's happening, and away you go. It's really simple, but as I say, it took a long time to make sure that we were giving people instructions that were, you know, clear and simple, but not too simple.
Yeah, what kind of questions do people come with? So for some people, and certainly I often talk about being an introvert and meeting new people, turning up to something like Street Wisdom could feel quite intimidating.
Yeah.
I would definitely be nervous going to something like that. I'd be thinking, is everyone going to be smarter than me? Am I meant to know things that perhaps I won't know? What do people need to turn up thinking about or prepare for?
Yeah.
What kind of questions will people have in mind?
There's a lot of questions bundled into those questions, but I would say that very little. You just need to be a little bit curious.
Okay.
Everybody in one way or the other has got a what's next question. What's next at work? What's next in my diet? What's next for my body? What's next for what color am I going to paint that wall? And it's essentially, you just need to be thinking a bit about what's next.
That's a really good way of thinking about it. Yeah, just what's your most important what's next question?
Yeah.
And like you say, that can be as simple as, well, what am I going to do in my lounge next?
Absolutely.
It feels like it needs a refresh.
Absolutely.
I think a bit of structure and support around answering those what's next questions can be really helpful, which I think, certainly from my friends who told me about Street Wisdom, that's what they said it gave them. I'm sure one of my friends said they came working out whether they wanted to move house or not. Yes. So just like a really kind of, they couldn't quite figure out whether to stay or go. And that was their question.
That's a good, you reminding me. I was doing one in Chinatown in San Francisco one time. And there was a guy, a friend of mine from Pixar, and he was asking exactly that question.
Oh, really?
And he was wandering around in the market and suddenly looked up, and this often happens, you suddenly see something, it makes sense, and it said, you know, in America they call a real estate, they call it realty.
Right.
And he looked up, and it said, hang on, realty. And the guy's was named Mr. Ong, hang on.
Oh,
but
okay.
He looked at it and he went, that's it.
Hang on. Don't move.
And he said, he decided not to move. I think you're absolutely right that you get a whole range of people coming to Street Wisdom, from people who have never done anything like it to people who have been like, have got the t-shirt, been to the ashram, the whole thing. And actually, it's the people who have done more self-development. I often say to them, chill out, you know, calm down.
That's what you're telling me, isn't it, essentially?
No, not really. I think there's a sort of perfectionist in us, right? That says, I am going to do this and I'm going to do it. I'm going to change
properly
my life. I'm
going to do it properly.
And I really feel like it's good to to relax a bit. And it's more to do with turning the world around you into like your creative playmate. People just often go through the world head down, heading to the next thing. But actually, when you connect with the world around you, it wants to play. And if it's anything, Street Wisdom is a playful experience.
Yeah.
What often happens is people come with a question and the question morphs. So they go, there was a woman that came, for example, and she said, my question is, I want to find out what the oldest building in this street is. And I said to her, just hang on, you know, this is supposed to be about you. She said, no, that's what I want to do. It's like, okay, honey, go for it. She went to him and she came back. She was chuckling. I said, what? She said, well, the question changed. I said, tell me. She said, well, I went out looking for the oldest building in the street. But as it changed into, what am I going to do when I retire?
Okay.
So she was... That
is quite a big transition.
But it was about age and it was about redundancy and so on and so forth. But it took her a while to stumble around and find the question. Very often, the question... People come back with a really good question. And we encourage people to say, look, sometimes they look a bit crestfallen, like, oh, my Street Wisdom experience is over. And I like to explain to them, look, it's not an experience, it's a technique. And once you've done it once, you can do it anytime. You can do it anywhere.
Yeah.
In fact, I do Street Wisdom-y type things in 3 minutes in a corridor, in a client. I'll switch on that connection with the outside world and get a bit of inspiration.
Yeah, I think it's just that allowing yourself to, like you say, not be purposeful all of the time. And there's such a pressure now. I was listening to a podcast this morning about the pressure to kind of be productive.
Oh,
and this idea of we must spend every moment being productive, and that productivity tends to equal very kind of tangible outputs.
Yes.
I think one of the things that I'm trying to kind of reframe in kind of my own mind, especially having worked in big corporate companies for a long time, is that it is okay to go for a walk. I think it's so much harder when you're in a company and you've got a job and you've got a big long to-do list and you've got a manager and all the pressures of meetings and all that kind of stuff, which is the reality for most people. Actually having the confidence to stop and pause, to go for a walk, to be a bit less kind of purposeful in a more kind of traditional way, I think does take quite a lot of confidence.
Yeah.
So definitely I would encourage people to think about, Street Wisdom, people can turn up with other people. You don't have to do it by yourself. I'm sure people could do it in their own companies once they maybe had a come and had a go.
Yeah, they do.
Is that something that happens?
Absolutely.
I can really imagine people doing that.
It's a way of reclaiming the lunch hour. So,
you
see people doing that. And
that's a good idea.
They can do it by themselves. They can do it with other people. I think you're absolutely right. I go even further and say, the street is the new workplace. So when you leave the office to go out into the street, or you leave wherever you're working, it's sort of in a weird way, it's not exactly time off. It's another way of working. Your brain is working in a different way. So that that rest period that you're having is allowing yourself to get creative. If you think about it, Archimedes had his eureka moment, not at the office, but in the bath, remember?
Did he? I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, you
know,
he got into the bath, yeah. And he saw that the level of the bath rose, and it suddenly realized this was about the displacement of materials, and it was basically right. Solved the problem that he was, the king, I think, has said he's going to cut his head off if he didn't solve the problem. So he's there working at the office, and then Mrs. Archimedes probably runs in bath saying, Archie, you know, chill out. And as he slides into the bath with his duck and goes, ah, oh, bang, the thinking happens.
That was the moment.
And I think we, you know, with Taylorism and all that stuff, and this idea also that, which is breaking down now, but that work happens in an office, we've come to this very narrow view of what work is. And, and being busy is looking busy very often. You know, it's like, I want to look busy. I appear to be being productive. But this word, you're right as well, the word productivity, it's in my book, I can't remember, but I think it's only about 80 years old with it.
Oh, really?
And it's a very modern concept. And as you rightly say, it was very much linked to material output. It's a very industrial way of thinking about the way we use our time and chunking our time in blocks, all of which have to be. There's almost a moral association as well. If you're being productive, you're more godlike, you're more worthy member of society, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, maybe more valuable.
And if you think about vagabonds, and the word error means to wander. The word vagabond, vaga means to wander. We're very suspicious and very unsettled by wandering and by wanderers.
Yes.
Because they seem to confront us going, now hang on, I was told at school I have to go this way. And you get these people, entrepreneurs are like that, right?
Yeah.
They sort of wander about, and we yearn for it, but it frightens us. Mm. So something like street wisdom is like a mini experience, just to reawaken the wanderiness. It's why I call the book Wonderful.
Yeah.
Because it is, the subtitle is, you know, find the wonder in the everyday, every day.
Oh,
and
nice.
I think that people aren't, I mean, I've had to discover this myself. I'm not a natural wanderer. I'm tall and angular, and I tend to go places fast.
You're much taller than me.
Inside, we're the same height, right? But we're doing a good job sauntering here.
We are.
But it's not my natural state. I had to stumble into it. But it's been really, really helpful to understand that to slow down is also to speed up in a strange way. You slow down to speed up. I think any tempo, you know, as a musician, any tempo gets boring after a while. And what we're doing now is we're just interrupting the pattern, and we're going, you know what, let's go slow. It's the ability to choose your tempo, I think, is what's important. That's the mindful thing. It's not the tempo you choose, right?
Yeah, I don't think slow is better than fast. That's what a lot of people are looking for as well, that idea of when we talk about what you can control and what you can't, and often we spend too much time worrying about things that we can't control.
Yeah.
I think often one of people's ambitions and aspirations is to feel like they have more control over their own kind of choices. And you mentioned the book, which is called Wonderful. What will people get from the book? Why should they read the book?
Well, what I did in the book is I sort of looked back over 5 or 6 years of street wisdom and sort of tried also for myself to go for a bit of a wander into what's going on. So I took little moments of a street wisdom type walk, like, for example, the moment you bump into a stranger.
Which happened to us today. Well, not a stranger, but somebody that we weren't expecting to see. Literally, we got out of the lift ready to go for the walk.
Absolutely.
And one of my best friends walked into the building.
Yeah.
And it was like, what were the chances? And I'm now going to have lunch with her, which is very
exactly.
exciting.
Exactly. So that's synchronicity. So one chapter's all about that. It's like, what is going on? Why do people bump into people that they know unexpectedly? Another one is about how to awaken up your internal guidance system, the sat-nav of your soul, as I put it. So these little moments about, very practical, they've all got their exercises, and there's little films that come with it, you go on the website. But then interleaved between it is a little, like what we're doing now, I go for walks with people that have been interesting to me and helpful to me on my way. So Charles Handy's one, and Ken Robinson is one, and
brilliant.
And Susie Walker from Psychology. There are lots of different friends, and we just go for a wander. And we see what comes of that. And what you find is that we like to say in street wisdom, answers are everywhere. So when you start asking questions, you start seeing answers everywhere, but also so are teachers. Partly what I think is going on in the book is encouraging us when we're out in the streets to reach out to strangers, have a chat, share as we might have done in the past, share what's on your mind and ask people's opinion. You'd be amazed the wisdom that the casual passerby has for you. I mean, and I think if one thing I'm hoping for is that the book encourages people to sort of cross the distance between them and other passers-by in the street. Maybe have a short conversation. Maybe make our cities a bit more lovable.
If there's one thing that my family and friends know me for, it's being an amazing gift giver. I owe it all to Celebrations Passport from 1-800-Flowers.com, my one-stop shopping site that has amazing gifts for every occasion. With Celebrations Passport, I get free shipping on thousands of amazing gifts. And the more gifts I give, the more perks and rewards I earn. To learn more and take your gift giving to the next level, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
So we're sitting here now having a lovely coffee in central London under some very nice heaters, and the coffee shop is called The Life Goddess and it's delicious. This is one of your regular haunts, is it, you brought us to? It is.
One of the things I've got my eyes and ears always open for is experience, because people describe me as an experience engineer. It's a bit wanky, but essentially that's, I think, a lot of what we are. People value experiences very highly, and when you're in the arts you're definitely experience engineering, creating experience for people. But I think people like this cafe do it. Yeah. The minute you go in there, the coffee's great,
plants everywhere, lights
but it just
everywhere.
Feels like, and also the people are great, and they love great food and stuff like that. So as much time as I can spend in street cafes, the better, I think.
Yeah.
And here we are, wrapped up against the cold, having a lovely time.
It was my thing for 2020, is every new town or even village or city that I go to, I try and arrive early enough that I can go and discover a local coffee shop, because I love a coffee or a tea. Yeah. And yesterday I was in Taunton, and that's what I did. I just sort of wandered in, didn't have a pre-planned destination. I just look around for the one that I think looks interesting. And then, funnily enough, the place I went into, which is called Number One Coffee, also support the Samaritans, who my sister works for. So when you talk about all the synchronicity of everything coming together, I'm starting to spot it.
So did you use the word just? Oh, I just wandered around. Maybe you didn't just wander around. Wandering is, as a friend of mine says, let's get lost and find lunch. That's another thing about, allowing yourself to feel a little bit lost and discover something rather than always know where you're going. Anyway, that's another whole other podcast.
So we started the podcast today, and I was asking you about who inspired you, and you mentioned Charles Handy.
Yeah.
Let's come back to Charles, because some people listening might not know who Charles is, so perhaps you can tell us a bit about who he is and why he's been such an inspiration for you.
Yeah, Charles would hate to be described as, but I think he's a national treasure, a living national treasure, like those wonderful potters in Japan. He's a social philosopher, he's a writer. He was for many years he had a very squiggly career. He was for many years an oil executive. And then his wife, Liz, said, I think you've become the most boring man I know.
That's feedback for you.
It was time to change. But he's really written some of the seminal books on sort of the philosophy in business. So things like The Empty Raincoat, The Age of Unreason, and so on and so forth. And he's a commentator and a wise, funny, soulful man who looks at the world and has this lucid, limpid writing style that he says very simple things, but they stay with you for life. And I met him and Liz early, probably 25 years ago. Liz taught me photography, and Charles has taught me everything else, right? No, he's the sort of person, he doesn't tell you stuff, he asks you questions.
Oh, and those questions people, those smart, insightful people who ask you brilliant questions.
If anyone wants a really, really powerful and simple read, he's just written a book called 21 Letters, and it was really 21 letters to his grandkids about life. And he's also got a wonderful concept, which is the second curve. He's written a book called Second Curve, in which basically, you know, we go through a period of life, we go through a stage of our career, and you get to the point you go like, this is good, but I'm like, what's next? And he calls that the second curve. And how do you get from one curve and get enough momentum to leap onto the second and third and fourth curve? So the second curve is a beautiful book, really worth looking at.
And from you've known him for a long time.
Yeah.
What would be the one thing that you feel like he has really taught you, or the thing that has really stuck with you, that you found has been useful in all the different things that you've then gone on to do?
Yeah, I mean, I wish I had learned to ask questions rather than just blather, but I haven't done that. The thing about him and Liz, who died sadly last year, but great life, actually some very practical things. When I met them, I had a much bigger company and I was doing lots of variety of things. And they gently encouraged me, by demonstrating it themselves, what it looked like to have a life that was livable and purposeful. So he would, for 6 months of the year, she would support his life as a speaker and thinker. 6 months of the year, he would carry her photography bag. And they had this very...
Oh, nice.
Their life-work balance was amazing. And by being around Charles, I think I've learned a lot about how to simplify and be honest with myself about what I'm really doing, what I do need to do, what I don't need to do. And for that, I think it's been an incredibly practical, but ultimately had a big impact on my professional life and my life in general.
So it sounds like he's been a real role model for you.
Role model.
And actually being able to, sometimes you need to see it to believe that that's possible. Yeah. Are kind of mentors and role models something that you've proactively looked for in your career, or is it more that they've come to you or you've happened across them? Is it something you've been intentional about or not really?
With hindsight, I guess you could say, but my experience is that I don't think I was intentional, but what I do have is I do have a real appetite for what seems exciting new stuff. I think if I've got one quality that is really helpful is I do like to be a beginner. I've got that kind of, oh, this is great, I'm going to start, you know, like I'm starting conducting, and I definitely feel like a beginner there. And I think so when I meet people like Charles, or there's a wonderful director we work with in my opera company called David Glass, I just, when you meet someone like David, who's a treasure trove of theatre knowledge and technique, I just like a mosquito, I stick my proboscis in there and suck hard. So I've learned a huge amount from him. I think one of the earliest influences on me is my dad, Bernie, Bernard Pearl. And I only realised this sort of recently. Of course, your parents affect you in many ways. Both my parents have. But I think the thing that my dad was a model of, which I hadn't realised till recently was unusual, was he had two careers at once. So he was a dentist and a barrister side by side, which at the time was really, really...
I mean, that's got to be an unusual combination.
Totally.
And how did he do that?
With difficulty. 3 days of the week, he did days a week. And he didn't do it for the whole of his life. But he was somebody, he started out as a scientist, and he was came from very humble beginnings. He was a dentist. But he was always studying. He studied history and philosophy and so on. And then he fell in love with the law. And actually, as a hobby, really, he studied the law. He didn't intend to be a barrister. But once he passed the exam, he suddenly thought, you know what, I quite like this.
I'm going to do this.
So he's kind of stumbled into it, a bit like you were describing the work you do. He said, oh, I actually like this. And so he was a dentist and barrister. Then he became a coroner. Then he led a chambers, and he was effectively a judge. And then he was really an artist. He fell in love with drawing, and he would draw and draw and draw the whole time. So I think having someone like that around me,
like a real polymath.
He was a polymath, and I wouldn't have described it that way when he was alive, but looking back now, I realise he was an example of somebody who was advancing on all fronts. It was and.
Yeah.
And he didn't have any issue with that, whereas other people said, well, are you a dentist or a barrister? And he was like, well, I'm both. So I think that had a real effect on me. I thought that was normal. I only now realise it isn't normal.
So we talked a bit earlier about, you know, this kind of paradox of people wanting to feel like they're planning, but you've got to keep some flexibility and feel a bit more comfortable with ambiguity. Mm. When you now think about the next 5-10 years of what you might be spending your time doing, how do you start even thinking about that? Or do you not? Do you think more short term? How do you think about your career now when you do think about kind of your what next questions, I guess?
So what do I think? I think one principle that I've got is I'm more inclined now to step back and have a look at this funny, angular, spiky-haired bloke and go, what's he for? Rather than what do I want to do? Well, of course, that's important, but I'm more like, what would you use him for? And I look at myself a bit more objectively and think, where can I create the most value? And I think that's important. I also think that selfishly, working with lovely people and peers and learning from people and stuff is something that's very important to me. I feel like I'm sort of in the zone, sort of after many decades of going, oh, I get how it fits together. I think my red thread is about what I describe as the magic of the everyday. You know, I started life, if you like, on the stage at Covent Garden. It's very, very heightened, very artificial. Mm-hmm. But in some ways, that's where I learned, for me, that in the music, in the emotion, is something very real, really realer than what you see out here on the street, if you like. So for me, I'm always looking for the magic that's in the everyday. I spend a lot of time in very ordinary circumstances, and I feel that that's, I don't think I decided that, but I think I'm being nudged that way. So I think that street wisdom is a lovely surprise gift that life has given me, and it means that I think the next 5-10 years I'll be doing more non-profit work and exploring this public realm. It's not business, it's not the arts, it's somewhere in the middle. We're at the beginning of 2020, and I'm optimistic with fears like Madeleine Albright, and I think that people like us who've had the good luck to be developing skills to work with executives and others, I think there's going to be a broader calling for our work. I think we're in for chaotic times of big change. That's not a bad thing necessarily, but I think probably I'll be finding ways of applying what I know to offering it anyway to perhaps the government and to perhaps the civil society and so on, doing a little bit more societal work. And I think joy is a funny old thing. I used to think, well, oh, these people sitting around, you know, cross-legged in their tie-dye talking about having a joyful life, you know, go and suffer a bit. But I do think you're not going to help unhappy people if you join them. So in a way, there's something for me about sustaining my energy and my, you know, my physique and, you know, my body, just so I can remain available, remain supple, remain, you know, mobile and remain relevant and helpful.
And we always ask this question when we kind of finish our interviews with people, but for all of our listeners, what piece of career advice would you give to people now? So it doesn't matter what stage, we have people listening who are potentially even retiring. So, you know, and people at the start of their career. So a really wide range of listeners all over the world.
Yeah.
What is your one piece of career advice?
So I think about this with my kids, Elsa and Zachary, and it's going to sound incredibly obvious, but given the twists and turns that lie ahead, is let yourself fall in love with something, because you're going to need energy. And don't be beguiled by people that are doing stuff that you can do, because sometimes, oh, I can do it, so I will do it. Mm-hmm. Helpful to do that, but that follow the itch, follow the flirt, follow the thing that it's just at the edge of your awareness, because that is, I think, your nature speaking back to you. And I think, I don't think there is a job for somebody. You can do many different jobs, but if you know what's in your nature, you can apply that to any job. You can run a laundry or a cake shop with that kind of, if you know your why, as it were, if you know what's in your essence. But you're not going to know it, by, as we've said, by going to a career advisor or listening even to a podcast. It's by trying, tripping over, standing up, wandering, stumbling, feeling your way across the stones.
Really inspiring to hear that, and I think for lots of people reassuring to feel like you don't need to know the answers right now and you can kind of learn as you go. So David, thank you so much for talking to us today. It's been brilliant to hear your squiggly career story.
Thank you for having me. Let's squiggle our way through 2020.
Let's.
If there's one thing that my family and friends know me for, it's being an amazing gift giver. I owe it all to Celebrations Passport from 1-800-Flowers.com, my one-stop shopping site that has amazing gifts for every occasion. With Celebrations Passport, I get free shipping on thousands of amazing gifts. And the more gifts I give, the more perks and rewards I earn. To learn more and take your gift giving to the next level, Visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Hey, y'all. Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit DiscoverSouthCarolina.com.